Well, this sermon topic was originally scheduled for next week, and I was going to take this week off. So it's not too late. Every Middlesex village and farm, you all recognize the line, and it comes from The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere by Longfellow, a Unitarian, about Paul Revere, a Unitarian. It begins, and don't get scared, I'm not going to do the whole poem. Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is still alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, if the British march by town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the Old North Church as a signal light. One if by land, two if by sea, and I, on the opposite shore, shall be ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm. Well, there are a bunch of people right now in the United States who think that they are part of the tradition of the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, who are calling to the country folk to be up and to arm, and who want to have their own tea party in the shadow and footsteps of the original patriots. And it would be easy just to dismiss it and say, well, they have nothing to say to us, except when you deal with what our own founding fathers and mothers and revolutionaries were about, there are some similarities, and they are uncomfortable. Our revolution came from not wanting taxation without representation. As Dr. Phil would say, how's that working out for you? So that we have taxation, we have some of the finest representation money can buy. And it was, of course, important because Paul Revere's call was true. The British were coming, and we had to fight them, and we had to kill them, because if not, we'd have high taxes and would be speaking English. Well, I mean, there is the Prince Charles thing, but I'm not sure that that's a step up or down. I don't want to offend any British people here. We were, our revolutionaries were, privileged for the most part. Landowners, educated, a lot of Unitarians, some Universalists, but a lot of Unitarians. And they were in a privileged position, educationally and financially. When you look at the rest of the colonial world, whether it is in the 17th, 18th, 19th, or 20th century, the people who fought this revolution and for the United States were in an almost uniquely blessed position. But their complaint was a true complaint. Their pain was a true pain. And their sense of not having power to govern themselves as opposed to being ruled by someone else was legitimate. When I look at what's going on with the Tea Party folks today, they are not completely wrong in how they see part of the problem. And how they see part of the problem is that there are people who are benefiting enormously from our social and economic situation, and the everyday man and woman is getting crumbs. There is an alignment between the populist left and the populist right, both of whom see the fat cats getting the feast and the regular folks getting the shaft. And there would be a tremendous opportunity for an alliance that would really change society, except for a few not trivial facts. One is what the Tea Party people are warning. Their clarion call of the danger is not that the British are coming, it's that there are other immigrants coming. And immigrant is a code word for black and Hispanic. Nobody is putting up pickets at the northern border with Canada except to try to stop any black or Hispanic people who may be coming in from Canada. There is a coded racism and xenophobia in the anti-immigrant push and fear that the Tea Party people are putting out. It is not that immigration is not a legitimate issue, but you have to look at the issue and at the coding and understand where the anger, the animus, and the fear are coming from. They are also warning the things more about immigrants. The immigrants are, of course, coming and taking all of the good jobs. Well, there's one fantastic job an immigrant got that maybe some of us would want our own children to have, but I don't think so. Because if any of our children were elected governor of California, we'd demand a recount. It's not a good job. And most of the time, they're taking the good jobs, is, again, code for I'm uncomfortable with their color and with their culture. As long as the Tea Party is xenophobic and racist, it will not be able to grow and make the connection to the fierce unrest that stirs at the soul of so many Americans. It is also anti-gay and claims that there is a gay agenda. Now, I, as many of you know, I have been doing same-sex ceremonies of union since 1969, and I am very gay friendly, and I have never gotten the gay agenda. I mean, I'm on the internet, I have at least two or three email addresses, and they never send me the agenda. Well, there's one exception to that. I did get the gay agenda once, and it was on the day that same-sex marriage was okayed for California, that brief window when it was open. And the agenda said this: please, if you're going to go down to City Hall and get married, don't go overly outrageous. Don't go completely West Hollywood on us. We would like to present a little easier aspect to the larger community and not let all of the news media zero in on the most outrageous outfit. And that was that one experience that I had of the gay agenda. I'm still trying to figure out how it threatens my life, how it threatens my marriage, how it threatens my children and my children's marriage. It is not my view that there is so much love in the world that we can just afford to throw it away if we don't like how it manifests itself when we're dealing with consenting adults. So you're anti-immigrant and anti-gay. There's also the very, to me, explicit racism in much of what's going on in the whole Tea Party movement. Again, taking our country back is code for the non-legitimacy of the President of the United States, because the President of the United States happens to be a true African-American with an African name and two names that are Arabic and Muslim associated. And so all of this becomes a code for many people who deny that there's a racial aspect, but to me there's a clear racial aspect in the animus, because it's not really about policy. It really has been about personality. And that too has been a code for being about race, the other, and the stranger. These are very frightening movements within our society. It is not that we have never had times when we had xenophobia. It is not that we have a history that is without racism or a history that is without homophobia. We know that all of those things have existed, but now they're existing in a more organized manner. And if the anger is seemingly inchoate, it becomes organized around those three major issues of race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. And that's a dangerous trifecta for a society. All of these things may be discussable issues, but from the hate mail that I receive, mostly not from the congregation, but mostly, but from the hate mail that I receive as a columnist, I really see the anger and the fear and the growing incivility of our discourse, which has become shouting and throwing. And I have to admit, I had some hesitation about handing out stones on the way in here. And so only those of you who are without sin, and only after the sermon is done. It's because we really have become a fiercely angry and frightened nation. And in some ways it's understandable, and in some ways it's like the original revolutionaries. We are still so blessed as a nation, even in bad times, that to turn to the anger and to turn to the fear and to look for the stranger in our midst, or the people we consider to be strangers, and not to see our common humanity, is very disturbing. But it brings forth the question about what is our warning? What is our, if not good news, our difficult news to every Middlesex village and farm? I assume it is not to be up and to arm, but it is to, I think, identify those things that are truly threats to ourselves, to our souls, to the body politic. And chief among those, ironically to me, when I do my list of things that I want to warn about, it is racism. The election of Obama did not was a step. It was not the end of a process, as we all realize. It is xenophobia. It is homophobia. It is all of the ways that we marginalize the other and see people not as connected to us by the common bonds of our humanity and our connection in the web of existence. It's the way that we stand apart, and it's the way that we let our fears push people away and break connections that could be loving and wonderful. That's one of the great things of coming together in a community like this, is to meet the other. I remember attending an Elie Wiesel talk in Pasadena, and he was asked about all of the ways that in the Middle East people have kept themselves from each other. And he said, you know, it's so amazing that people have this fear of the other. When I see somebody who's different from me, I want to come over and sit down and break bread and learn. We have so much to give each other. Today, not coincidentally with the sermon, is Yom HaShoah. It is the day that commemorates the tragedy of the Holocaust. A saying came out of the Holocaust that was very simple to say, and it was never again. Never again. It's a slogan, a promise that was broken, because it has been again and again and again. And it has been, and the lesson of the Holocaust is not simply that it happened to Jews, that it happened to my family and my wife's family. It's that it was perpetuated by human beings against human beings who couldn't see the humanity in each other. The tragedy of humanity is our tribalism. Our tribalism that we always think about tribes as being Native American tribes or African tribes, and we don't for a minute understand the tribalism in the Balkans, the tribalism in rural America, the tribalisms of all of those ways that we come together that distinguish us and we feel make us better than other people and other groups. And it can be organized around religion or ethnicity. It can be organized around a sports team, about class, about education. There are all of these ways that we manifest our tribalism and push the other away and close our hearts to the other. And so we call them these terrible names. We call them dogs and pigs and vermin and rats. We use all of these pejoratives for people of other races, whatever that means, ethnicities and religions, in order to make them less than we are. And in the process, we make ourselves less than we can and should be. Racism, xenophobia, homophobia all have two victims. Well, three, really. The people whom we hate and fear, ourselves, and those who see us modeling those kinds of behaviors. The impulse, and I referenced this briefly last night during my talk, we watched the program on the life of the Buddha, and it ended with something that was very powerful to me. And it was, in looking to be compassionate and serene and accepting and connecting to the world, we also have to take ourselves from who we are and where we are and understand the impulse to fear, the impulse to hate, the impulse to distance ourselves from our sisters and brothers of other persuasions and tribes. To know that no one is immune from this instinct. No one is immune, not Unitarian Universalist. There's no Unitarian Universalist exceptionalism that makes us non-haters, non-judgmental. We can demonize the others, usually with a better vocabulary and longer bumper stickers, but we still can do it just like everybody else because we share the same humanity and the same potential for inhumanity. But what we can do as human beings of all tribes and religions and ethnicities is we have the ability to reason. We have the ability to step back from our impulses. We have the ability to say, look, I feel it. I'm not going to hate myself because I have this impulse to push away from the stranger. I will accept that within me because that then gives me power and control over myself. To say no to that impulse, to say no to that adrenaline, that epinephrine of righteousness and self-righteousness that can affect any human being. I think that in trying to accept and be enriched by others, we have to accept the complexity of our own selves, our own humanity, and understand that like everyone else, we have interests, we have instincts, we have fears, but as soon as we know that, we now have choice and we have power to step away from the anger, to retreat from the fear, and to look into the eyes and the hearts of the other and know that we are connected. Every Middlesex village and farm to be up and to step back from the arms, to step back from the arms that we understand as an extension of our arms to hit the other and extend our arms to embrace the other. That's the choice. It's a choice that all of us have in almost every moment and in almost every encounter. The song from the 60s, if I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. You can hammer and use that hammer to destroy, or you can use that hammer to sculpt something of beauty. You can use your impulses, my impulses, our impulses to hate, to fear, or to choose to love, to embrace, to see the self and the other, to go as the song so brilliantly did, from I to you to we. We have good news to shout out. And it's not simply a warning about all of the negativity out there that they do, or all the negativity that we are capable of, but all of the love that we are capable of, and the power of our choices, and the enormity of our hearts.